Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Bankruptcy Conversions and Appeals Edition. Thank you for tuning in. The Supreme Court recently issued two unanimous decisions in bankruptcy cases, Harris v. Vigilon and Bullard v. Hyde Park Savings Bank. In Harris v. Vigilon, decided on May 18th, involved the conversion of a Chapter 13 bankruptcy case into a Chapter 7 bankruptcy case. In Chapter 13 bankruptcy, the debtor is permitted to keep his assets, but his post-petition wages are property of the bankruptcy estate and may be distributed to creditors. In Chapter 7 bankruptcy, the debtor's assets are immediately liquidated and made available to creditors, but post-petition wages remain the debtor's. The question in this case was whether, upon conversion from Chapter 13 to Chapter 7, post-petition wages still in the hands of the Chapter 13 trustee remain available to creditors or must instead be returned to the debtor. In an opinion delivered by Justice Ginsburg, the court held unanimously that the debtor was entitled to the return of any post-petition wages not yet distributed by the Chapter 13 trustee. The contrary judgment of the Fifth Circuit was reversed and the case remanded. Bullard v. Hyde Park Savings Bank, decided on May 4th, concerned whether a debtor could appeal a bankruptcy court's order denying confirmation of the debtor's proposed repayment plan. In an opinion delivered by Chief Justice Roberts, the court held unanimously that the order denying confirmation was not a final order subject to immediate appeal. The judgment of the First Circuit, which had dismissed the debtor's appeal for lack of jurisdiction, was affirmed. To discuss these cases, we have Zvi Rosen, who is a visiting assistant professor of law at the Hofstra University Maurice A. Dean School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Rosen.
Hi, my name is Zvi Rosen. I'm a visiting professor at the Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University. And today I'm going to be talking about two cases that were both heard by the Supreme Court on April 1st, and they've already been decided as of mid-May 2015. So the two cases are Harris v. Vigilon and Bullard v. Hyde Park. They're both cases involving Chapter 13 bankruptcy. Now, originally bankruptcy was sort of a straight liquidation, what I call Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and over time, we saw the development of wage earner plans originally among the bankruptcy courts, then was codified into the bankruptcy code in the 30s, and it's continued to evolve through today. The idea basically is where a debtor has regular income, and the debtor gets to keep his or her property and pay back for secured debts and whatever portion of unsecured debts they can afford to pay. And at the end of a plan, which is usually 5 years, they end up with a discharge of their debts and to keep a property. This is in contrast to Chapter 7, where you get a discharge of all your debts and don't have to pay anything, but you also have to give up everything. So the first step after you file a petition for relief under Chapter 13 of the Bankruptcy Code is to generate a plan and get it confirmed with either the agreement of your creditors or over the objection of your creditors. So in Bullard, which we're going to talk about first, the issue is whether or not an order denying confirmation of a Chapter 13 plan is appealable as of right, as a final order, or only as a interlocutory appeal. So the facts are straightforward and are pretty much agreed to. The debtor in this case owns a two-unit piece of residential property and lives in one of the units. And this is key because you are not allowed to modify your mortgage under bankruptcy law where it's a single unit residential property. However, where one of the units is being rented out, then you are allowed to modify the mortgage. So Hyde Park held a mortgage in an amount of a little under $400,000. Hyde Park Bank filed a proof of claim amount of about $350,000, and it does not reflect any pre-petition arrears. So parties disagree as to how much a property is worth, but one estimate is $245,000, other one is $285,000. However, all the parties agree that the property is worth substantially less than Hyde Park is owed in the property. So Bullard proposed a plan that would pay Hyde Park in full the secured amounts of her claim, so the amount of her property is actually owed, and would treat the rest of her claim as an unsecured claim, and that he would be paying the secured part of a claim for a period of longer than 5 years. So the bankruptcy court, Hyde Park objected, saying that this sort of hybrid plan should not be permitted. A hybrid plan is where they would be modifying the mortgage and be paying it for more than 5 years. And this case is not actually about the substance of the case. It's about the jurisdictional issues on appeal. But very briefly, the court held that a hybrid plan proposes to pay a debt for over 5 years cannot also involve modification of the rights of a secured creditor. So the plan was denied as being unconfirmable under the bankruptcy code. Bullard then appealed to the bankruptcy appellate panel, which is a panel of bankruptcy judges which sits in lieu of a district court to hear appeals of bankruptcy cases in some circuits. Now, Bullard both filed a notice of appeal saying he had a right to and also moved for and received leave to file an interlocutory appeal. The bankruptcy appellate panel affirmed the decision of the bankruptcy court under a somewhat different rationale, basically saying that these sort of hybrid plans would pretty much never be permitted involving bifurcation. So a somewhat broader ruling, but once again, this was not the issue before the Supreme Court. So Bullard then filed a notice of appeal to the First Circuit Court of Appeals from the bankruptcy appellate panel, which sort of acts in lieu of district court in some circuits as an option, although, as the First Circuit made clear, the district court was always still an option. So the bankruptcy appellate panel denied Bullard's motion to certify the appeal to the First Circuit. The First Circuit then ordered briefing on both the jurisdictional merits question as to whether it even had jurisdiction to hear the appeal. And the First Circuit ended up ruling that it, in fact, did not have jurisdiction to hear the appeal because the order denying confirmation to bankruptcy court was not a final order for purposes of appealability or anything else, and that the confirmation was not a proceeding within the meaning of 28 U.S.C. 158, which says that rulings and proceedings are final orders. And so, and thus accordingly, neither was the decision of the bankruptcy appellate panel affirming that ruling. The First Circuit noted that Bullard had other options. Bullard could have appealed directly from a bankruptcy court to the circuit court, which is a rare move but a possible one in cases of unique legal issues. Bullard also could have appealed to the district court, which in turn could have ordered interlocutory appeal itself. So really in both cases that were heard that day, including this one, there's not really a lot of governing law. There is some law, and it really sort of comes down to a policy determination by the court. So the Supreme Court recognized this, and they saw that an argument that there was concern of fairness on one hand and judicial efficiency on the other hand. It was noted at argument that if a plan had been confirmed, then a creditor could appeal as of right because the creditor's rights are being affected by a final order. And the flip side, the plan was denied and the case dismissed, then the debtor could appeal as of right. And the question is, if those appeals are final orders, then how is it not a final order in cases where a plan is denied but there is a leave to file an amended plan? On the other hand, the court noted that there were many types of contested matters. They kept noting that Colliers provides a non-exclusive list of 47 contested matters, and everyone agreed that not all of them are appealable as of right. Now, interestingly, both the United States trustee and Bank of America submitted amicus briefs on behalf of Bullard, which strongly suggested that both the government and business interests preferred Bullard's position that there was a right to appeal orders denying confirmation. However, in the end, the court's opinion held that an order denying confirmation is not a final order appealable as of right. There wasn't really a lot of textual cover for this because there's not really a lot of text one way or another as to what is a final order in the context of bankruptcy. The court did note that a order denying appeal is not a court proceeding in the context of Section 157 of Title 28 of the Code, but the court's main concern was really about judicial efficiency, and more than that, the concern that, while it might not be an issue in small Chapter 13 cases, it's a possibility that debtors will abuse the system by filing constant appeals and dragging each one along for years at a time until they get to keep their house for longer and longer periods, and the court seemed unconvinced by the argument that the payment of adequate protection payments by the debtor would be sufficient to avoid this. Beyond that, though, the court seemed concerned about the effect of a decision that holds a denial of confirmation a final order for purposes of larger Chapter 11 plans. A concern was that in those cases, it would lead to abuse of a system by debtors with more complicated operations and more complicated cases. So the upshot of this decision is that an order denying confirmation of a plan in Chapter 13 bankruptcy is not a final decision, and the debtor needs to be careful in choosing an appellate strategy. Now, it may be in this case if a debtor was careful and the debtor said, okay, I want to go to a bankruptcy appellate panel. It's going to be more debtor-friendly than going straight to a district court or court of appeals. But by doing so, they sort of caught themselves in a pickle and they weren't able to go any further with their appeal. So the other case that day was Harris versus Vigilon, which involved in some ways simpler legal issues, an underlying issue. So Harris got through the stage of getting a plan confirmed, but then things broke down. Harris was behind on his mortgage by several thousand dollars at Chase Manhattan Bank, and to avoid foreclosure, he filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and a plan confirmed where he would pay Chase Manhattan Bank directly, and then pay a Chapter 13 trustee out of his paycheck to pay off the accumulated payments owed to Chase. So basically, the amount that he owed Chase in back payment out of confirmation was paid by the trustee, and the trustee was paid actually out of a wage order that had Harris's paycheck paid partially directly to the Chapter 13 trustee, while Harris had paid Chase Manhattan Bank directly. However, Harris once again fell behind Chase Manhattan Bank, and Chase Manhattan Bank then filed a motion for relief from the automatic stay, which would allow them to go forward on foreclosure. However, apparently for about a year, Chase Manhattan Bank and Harris were negotiating a modification of a mortgage. When that fell through, Harris filed the paperwork to convert his case to Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which he can do as of right. Now, all of this is fairly straightforward and common under bankruptcy law. The issue is Harris had been paying money steadily to the Chapter 13 trustee over this year, but Chapter 13 trustee had not been paying the money at Chase Manhattan Bank. Because if Chase Manhattan Bank foreclosed on a property, then that would be their entire recovery. As a result, when Harris converted Chapter 7 bankruptcy, the trustee was left holding about $5,000 in undistributed funds that Harris had paid. Now, the trustee Vigilon then used the funds to pay administrative fees, including both the United States trustee fee and her own fee, and then paid a remnant to another small secured creditor, an electronic store, an unsecured creditor. Now, in Chapter 7 bankruptcy, you don't owe any money that you make after a petition. And when you convert a case from Chapter 13 to Chapter 7, the petition date is the date you originally filed for the Chapter 13 bankruptcy. So in this case, it was a year and a half earlier. So Harris then moved to be refunded the monies, and the bankruptcy court appealed. He moved to refund the money, and the bankruptcy court said that he was entitled to refund the money. The district court affirmed that. The Eighth Circuit reversed and said the money did not need to be refunded to Harris. So it's an interesting question what happens to undistributed funds. Until 1994, it was an open question, and a lot of courts had held that the funds go into Chapter 7 estate. So Congress amended the bankruptcy law in 1994 to add Section 358 to Title 11, which makes clear that undistributed funds do not become part of a Chapter 7 estate on conversion unless the confirmation was made in bad faith. So effectively, if a confirmation from Chapter 13 was filed, then convert Chapter 7 bad faith, clearly frustrate creditors, then the undistributed funds are part of Chapter 7 estate. It's basically a measure to prevent abuse of Chapter 13 and 7. So the question becomes whether a trustee, Chapter 13 trustee, is able to distribute the funds, or has to return it. And the court's holding was fairly straightforward. Because the employment of a Chapter 13 trustee is terminated at conversion of the case to Chapter 7, that Chapter 13 trustee is not permitted to carry out any more duties as the Chapter 13 trustee and has returned the funds. So there were concerns bandied about that this ruling would allow gamesmanship, and the court's response to this is basically that this ruling shouldn't be an issue in most cases, because in most cases the Chapter 13 trustee is making frequent distributions to creditors, and really shouldn't be much there in the Chapter 13 trustee's account waiting to be disbursed. And so the court holds that the employment what chapter 13, trustee, ends as of as a conversion, and this means it well and truly ends. And chapter 13, trustee, is not allowed to distribute any funds that he or she still holds.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.